And now on FM, we begin a new book of the week. Actress and writer Rebecca Front reads from Curious, her collection of anecdotes and yarns that explore all that is remarkable about everyday life. In her first recollection, she returns to an episode from her childhood when an uninvited guest took up residence in the family living room.
Shortly before my brother's bar mitzvah, a stranger took over our home. We didn't exactly invite him. We didn't exactly block his way. He just quietly invaded, conquered us by stealth. And his greatest weapon was our own stupid politeness. My dad had an uncle called Merv, who lived in Miami. Merv was loud and funny, and like my dad's father, owned a barber shop. Transatlantic phone calls in those days were expensive and often afflicted with time delays and inaudibility. The upside to this was that when Merv and Dad had their occasional catch-ups, both had to shout to be heard, and Jeremy and I could sit on the stairs and listen to them.
"Listen, Charlie," Merv was yelling across 4,000 miles of airspace. "This fella walked into my shop the other day. Nice guy, Bob Lerman, a photographer. So I'm cutting his hair and I says to him, 'Funny thing, I got a nephew who's an artist in London. You should look him up. I think you get along.'
'He's coming to London?' asked Dad.
'Sure. He's going to Europe, the whole of Europe. I gave him your number.'"
From my vantage point on the top landing, I could see Dad tensing a little. It wasn't that he and Mum were inhospitable, just that, unlike Uncle Merv, they didn't become firm friends with people on first meeting. They liked to build up to it gradually, keep a little distance, take it one step at a time. For some weeks we heard nothing. The whole household was absorbed in Jeremy's forthcoming bar mitzvah, a bit like planning for a wedding, but without the element of anyone actually looking forward to it. Dad and I were out in the front garden one Saturday afternoon, trying somewhat ineptly to wrestle the holly bush into topiary form, when Mum came to the front door and announced there was someone called Bob on the phone. Dad disappeared for a few moments, and Mum came out to be with me. I was 9 and very sensible, but she could always see the danger lurking in apparently harmless scenarios, so leaving me alone with a pair of shears was never going to happen. Unfortunately, in avoiding this remote risk, she had overlooked the greater one of leaving my dad unattended on the phone. When he returned, he looked a little sheepish.
"I'm going to pick him up," he said.
"Who?"
"Bob Lerman."
"Who's Bob Lerman?" "Uncle Merv's friend," I explained, to speed things along a bit.
"You're going to pick him up? Where from?"
"Heathrow," said Dad.
"You don't even know him," said Mum.
She'd gone a bit shrill. I took the shears off her. "He said he'd be wearing a fishing hat." Apparently, Bob had had the foresight to check himself into a hotel in Kensington, but not to figure out how to get there on public transport or in a taxi. Even at the age of 9, I wondered how he was going to make it round the whole of Europe. As Dad drove away, Mum called after him,
"Don't bring him here!"
It was no surprise to any of us that when Dad returned a few hours later, the passenger seat was occupied by a guy in a fishing hat. Mum went to take his hand and instead found herself locked in a bear hug. This went on just long enough for her entire torso to stiffen with embarrassment, at which point Bob released her, then instantly gripped her anew by both shoulders, stared into her face and said, "Thank you for welcoming me into your home, Sheila." Mum nodded, accidentally implying assent, and Bob pushed past her into the house.
"Why is he here?"
she asked Dad in a whisper, furious but too polite to let Bob know it. "I honestly don't know, Sheila. I took him to the hotel and there was some mix-up, and he's got all this camera equipment. It's worth thousands of dollars. And he asked me to take care of the stuff, and suddenly I'd agreed to bring him here." The rules of polite society are so deeply ingrained in us that even if a guest is unwelcome, you somehow have to make them feel at home. The more you wish someone wasn't there, the more you feel the need to make them stay. When the last guest at a dinner party finally yawns, stretches and apologises for keeping you up so late, good manners dictate that you pretend not to have noticed the time and offer them a final nightcap. Don't you? Well, that's what my family always did. And Bob must have known pretty quickly that if he wanted people to take advantage of, he'd come to the right place. "So we can't offer you luxury, I'm afraid," Dad explained. "We haven't even got a spare room, but you're welcome to sleep on the settee tonight, and in the morning we'll get you checked into a hotel." "Okay," said Bob, in earnest acknowledgement that he understood, but with no suggestion of gratitude. "We're vegetarian, by the way," Mum apologised, implying that if Bob had a problem with this, we might be persuaded to reconsider. He didn't object, but as Mum stood up to head for the kitchen, he threw an unexpected curveball.
"I have a condition, kind of a blood glucose thing. I have to eat every 3 hours, day and night. Otherwise, I may slip into a coma."
"Gosh, how awful. Day and night? Well, yes, of course, we'll make sure you have plenty of snacks."
"And I have to sleep for at least 10 hours, uninterrupted."
Had we been more mathematically minded, we might have wondered how a man could sleep uninterrupted for 10 hours while still eating something every 3. But instead, we just sat there wrestling with the simpler equation that a stranger sleeping in your living room equaled no telly. When we got up the next morning, Bob was still asleep. Since the dining room had been temporarily filled with his ludicrous amount of luggage, we all had to eat breakfast standing up in our little kitchen. Holding our toast and whispering, it felt like we were guests at a particularly disappointing party. Jeremy and I had to go off to Sunday morning Hebrew classes, but we were assured by Mum and Dad that when we got home, Bob would have gone, and we'd have our telly, our eating space, and our normal lives back. But no. He was still there at lunchtime, and dinner time too. Apparently there'd been a mix-up over the money he'd allocated for his hotel expenses. I didn't fully understand, but the upshot was that if he could stay just one more night with us, then he'd be able to move in with a friend for a few days. We all assumed that friend was Bob speak for gullible stranger, but frankly we didn't care. Sunday night passed, as Saturday had, with no TV and nowhere to sit comfortably. He was there the next day too. He'd had a migraine, apparently, worse than any migraine previously known to medical science, and being unable to speak or hear, he naturally couldn't contact his friend. And so it went on, day after day after day. There was always another reason why he couldn't leave. He was ill or he was broke, he was scared of something or someone, or he had to wait until a complex set of circumstances came into play. Mum and Dad were simply at a loss as to how to handle him. He was thick-skinned, smart and ruthless. And my parents, slowly, too slowly, discovered that what they'd always assumed to be their greatest asset was in fact their fatal flaw. They were just too damn nice. But one day, over one of his 3-hourly meals, Bob casually dropped a bombshell.
"My wife, by the way, wanted me to thank you personally for the way you've taken care of me."
Mum, still clinging to her rock of politeness, refrained from saying, "Your wife? You have a wife?" and plumped instead for, "Oh, we didn't realise you were married."
"Oh, yes," said Bob, "to Morgan. We're very much in love. She's in college," he continued, "completing her studies."
"Into what?" Dad asked.
"Witchcraft," said Bob, earnestly, and Mum swallowed hard and pushed away the rest of her sandwich.
From that moment on, all Dad's suggestions for how to get Bob out of the house were met with a quivering rebuttal from Mum on the basis that if we messed with Bob, Morgan might wreak some long-distance occult revenge. "We could change the locks. His wife's a witch. We could take out a loan and buy him a plane ticket. His wife's a witch. We could stop feeding him for a few hours and let the hospital deal with him. I don't happen to find that kind of remark funny, Charlie. And what if she knows what we're saying?" "Oh, that's just mad. I'll tell you what's mad. You inviting a crazy guy into our home with stinking feet, a permanently empty stomach, and a wife back home with a sodding cauldron." It was almost a month before the final showdown came. Mum and I were in the kitchen, and Bob wandered in looking for yet more food.
"Hey, Sheila," he remarked,
looking at Mum with his head to one side, as if she were a scientific specimen. "Are you okay? You seem a little tense." Mum stared at him blankly for a moment, and I honestly thought she was going to say, "Are you kidding me? Yes, I'm tense. You've taken over my house." But she didn't. She just rubbed her eyes and said, "Well, I've got a lot on my mind. You know, the bar mitzvah and work." And then she gingerly added, "And you?" Bob moved towards her and placed his hand on her forehead. "I'm going to put my karma into you," he began. But before he could put anything into her, Mum had grabbed me by the hand, picked up her bag, and we'd gone. We walked very fast round to Auntie Dina's house, where Mum drank some brandy, and Dina told her what she already knew, that Bob had to go. Later that afternoon, Dad quietly and determinedly loaded the thousands of dollars worth of camera equipment and the many mysterious bags into the car boot. Then he walked into Bob's room, our living room as it had once been, and stood there, beady-eyed and barely containing his rage. "Time to go, Bob."
Well, Charlie, that friend of mine, the one with the room, he's going to be back in London from tomorrow, so if I could just stay here one more..."
"Time to go. Come on. Enough is enough. You're scaring my wife, you're upsetting my kids. It's time to go. Now, get in the car, please."
And slowly, reluctantly, and with an elaborate dumb show of bafflement, Bob gathered his few remaining belongings and followed Dad out of the house. A month or so later, Merv rang for a chat.
"Listen, Merv," called my dad across the Atlantic, "do me a favour, don't send me any more of your clients."
At first, Merv had no recollection of Bob. Finally, after much prompting, it came back to him.
"Oh, Bob, the photographer guy. Yeah, nice fella. Haven't seen him in a while. I think he went to Europe."
"He came here, to London. He stayed in our house for a month."
"A month? Boy, you two must have really hit it off."
Dad laughed bitterly. "No, Merv, we really didn't. He's a taker, a con man. We couldn't get him to leave." Merv hooted with disbelief.
"What do you mean you couldn't get him to leave? Why didn't you just tell him where to get off? Kick his ass out of there. Give the guy hell."
Dad was momentarily lost for words. From my vantage point on the top stair, I could see him considering all of these suggestions. They sounded so simple. Why had he let this stranger take over his home, upset his family, eat his food, take him for a ride?
"Because," he began, trying to articulate, "well, because..."
He was waving one arm at the unseen Merv, trying to reach for a plausible explanation, trying to understand it himself. Finally, there it was, the simple truth.
"Because I'm English."
Rebecca Front was reading from her book, Curious, True Stories and Loose Connections. The book was abridged by Sarah Davis and produced by Gemma Jenkins. In a couple of minutes, a special edition of Woman's Hour will be devoted to stress, asking, why is the workplace so stressful? How can you cope with a partner suffering from depression? And what are the signs that indicate someone close needs help? And what treatments and therapies are available?
Grace Kelly was always held up to me by my mother as what you could achieve if you brushed your hair more, didn't swear, and wore skirts of a decent length. I just can't be that.
On BBC Radio 4, Grace Dent challenges the myth that surrounds her name.
The Grace that I always identified with was Grace Jones. I understand this idea of a strong look. I feel at my maximum graceness when I'm in full Joan Collins-style power dress mode. Big hair, big eyes, tall shoes.
The state of grace.
It feels comfortable and it's sincere.
This morning at 11.